there are 40 factors about all sorts of things that the admissions office is looking at, and you haven't demonstrated or shown one situation in which all they look at is race and take from that stereotypes and other things. They're looking at the full person with all of these characteristics.
Yes, but our point is that all those other characteristics are not barred by the Constitution, and the use of race as a classification is barred by the Constitution.
But it has to be used, doesn't it?
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson today, during oral arguments in the first of two big affirmative action cases before the Supreme Court. She was questioning Patrick Strawbridge. He's the lawyer arguing that the University of North Carolina discriminated against Asian and white applicants by giving preference to other minority groups. The court also heard a similar case today against Harvard. The court's 6-3 conservative supermajority could throw out decades of precedent when it comes to affirmative action and higher education, even here in California. Affirmative action is barred in public universities, but it's still used by some private colleges. It's Monday, so our Legal Eagle is here, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Welcome.
Hello.
All right. First off, this is a challenge to a Supreme Court case from 2003. It's called Grutter v. Bollinger. What does the current law say when it comes to affirmative action?
Well, so I learned this morning that it's actually Grutter. It is from 2003. I remember that I was in law school when the case was decided, and it was basically asking whether or not we can consider race at all when it comes to higher education and their admissions processes, as you've mentioned. And the court says, in a really evenly divided decision, a 5-4 decision, that universities can consider race as one admissions factor because what the court recognizes, that bare 5-4 majority recognizes, is that there are compelling reasons that you want a diverse student body. And since then, about 40% of U.S. universities and colleges have considered race in their admissions programs. Mm-hmm. The question is whether they can continue to do so.
Right. Okay. So tell us a bit more about these cases. And let's begin with the North Carolina case. What's the issue here?
So the North Carolina case, it's obviously the University of North Carolina. It's a public university. And the challengers here are saying you discriminate on the basis of race. And because you're a public university, you're subject to the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, which really broadly says don't discriminate on the basis of race. And they actually rely on very forcefully from the beginning to the end of the almost 5 hours of oral arguments today, they rely on the landmark 1954 case, Brown versus Board of Education. And they say, Brown says that the Constitution must be colorblind and that colleges and universities cannot use color as part of their admissions policies. And so it's interesting that they're using that landmark civil rights case to argue against affirmative action programs here.
Right. That case, which was about integration. Yeah, it's ironic.
The case that ended separate but equal in public education.
Right. Okay. Is Harvard, is that case similar? What is it arguing? Why are there two separate cases?
Very similar, two separate cases, because Harvard is a private university. And so what we're actually asking with respect to Harvard is a similar question, but it's about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits groups that receive federal funding from discriminating on the basis of race. The 14th Amendment basically applies to government actors like a public university, like the University of North Carolina. And the Civil Rights Act applies to private actors like Harvard. And that's why there's two different cases. It's helpful for the newest justice, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, because she had to recuse herself from the Harvard case as she's still on the Board of Supervisors there, I believe.
And so in both cases, are they arguing that specific students have been harmed by this?
Yes. And what they're basically focusing on is the idea that Asian American students are harmed. And so what you heard a lot from challengers is that admissions is this zero sum game. There's only a certain number of seats that you can fill every year. You can't add different classrooms. You can't add more space to Harvard or the University of North Carolina. And so you're making decisions where if you favor one person, one applicant, if race is a plus factor for them, then it can harm other races. And they point mostly to Asian Americans, but also a little bit to Caucasians as well.
All right. So let's hear a bit of tape from Justice Clarence Thomas. He's questioning Ryan Park, the attorney for North Carolina, who is Asian American, by the way. And he said, quote, "I've heard the word diversity quite a few times, and I don't have a clue what it means." This is Justice Thomas saying that. "It seems to mean everything for everyone." And then he asked for a definition. And here is what Park said.
"Diverse groups of people actually perform at a higher level. So the most concrete possible scenario is stock trading. And there are studies that find that racially diverse groups of people making trading decisions perform at a higher level, make more efficient trading decisions. And the mechanism there is that it reduces groupthink and people have longer and more sustained disagreement. And that leads to a more efficient outcome."
Well, I guess I don't put much stock in that because I've heard similar arguments in favor of segregation, too.
Okay, what do you make of that exchange and Justice Thomas's response?
I think it was really smart for the attorney here to try and focus on stock traders, right? Trying to say to a conservative justice who we know is concerned about economic issues, let's say, that, look, this is a win. You want this. You want a society where we care about diversity. You want a society where we have people in rooms making big leadership decisions that come from different perspectives, and that includes different racial backgrounds. And let me tell you why. And Justice Thomas says, yeah, okay, basically, I've heard things from both sides. I'm not buying it, but thanks for responding to my question here. And it really is emblematic of something we heard over almost, again, 5 hours of oral arguments this morning, which is that I did not hear a lot of open-mindedness from the justices. I heard a lot of questioning. I heard a lot of pointed questioning. I heard a lot of questions that weren't really questions, but arguments to their colleagues. But I didn't hear a lot of, huh, that really changes the way I think about this.
Interesting. Well, let me play another clip that might illustrate what you're talking about. This is from Justice Elena Kagan. And here she is questioning the plaintiff's attorney, Patrick Strawbridge, and she is defending affirmative action programs.
It might be military leadership. It might be business leadership. It might be leadership in the law. It might be leadership in all kinds of different areas. Universities are the pipeline to that leadership. Now, if universities are not racially diverse, and your rule suggests that it doesn't matter, well, then all of those institutions are not going to be racially diverse either. And I thought that part of what it meant to be an American and to believe in American pluralism is that actually our institutions, you know, are reflective of who we are as a people in all our variety.
All right. So this does go to your analysis, your assessment that the justices are really, they seem to have their minds made up and they are interested in maybe just speaking to each other, perhaps.
Which makes sense because that's the only argument at this, or excuse me, the only audience at this point that matters, just to try and sway some of their colleagues. I know your mind is set in stone, but listen to what I'm saying. It's also, I think, later for a different audience that Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Jackson, when she was participating, they want to go on record as explaining verbally before we read their dissents why it is important to have in higher education schools that reflect America. Why is it important to have, as Justice Kagan lays out here, pipelines to leadership? What she says really clearly is there's no way that you can have, you know, the corner office of law firms, of companies, of government, of courthouses, of any place. There's no way you can have diversity if you don't have diversity in higher education. What I thought was really interesting is that later on, you heard the Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar, and she picks up on this and she reminds some of the conservative justices that she is a minority in arguing before the Supreme Court. And she says, you see, there's a huge disparity in women who argue before the Supreme Court, explaining to them why diversity in a pipeline matters.
Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming Lawmakers face more threats these days. We'll talk to State Senator Scott Wiener about that and the threats that he personally has faced in the wake of the attack on Paul Pelosi. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Federal and San Francisco prosecutors today announced charges against the man accused of attacking Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, last week. The San Francisco DA's office charged David DePape with a long list of crimes, including attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, and elder abuse. Federal prosecutors charged him separately with attempted kidnapping of Speaker Pelosi and assaulting her husband. Police say DePape broke into the Pelosi San Francisco home in the early morning hours on Friday, and he reportedly screamed, "Where is Nancy?" and allegedly attacked Paul Pelosi with a hammer, fracturing his skull. Prosecutors say DePape intended to interrogate the Speaker of the House and break her kneecaps as a lesson for other Democrats. He was also carrying rope, gloves, duct tape, and zip ties. Well, this incident highlights the growing threat our elected officials face, and it's not just federal lawmakers. Last month, a California jury convicted a man of threatening the life of State Senator Scott Wiener, who also represents San Francisco. That man was also convicted on several gun charges, and he was sentenced to 2 years felony probation. State Senator Scott Wiener joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so this man was convicted for sending you threatening messages and for weapons charges, not sentenced to prison. How do you respond to that? Not only the sentence, but just this general environment.
Well, he spent 5 months in prison pretrial. He was incarcerated for almost 6 months. And so his ultimate sentence was about a year, and with good time serve credits, it was reduced to about 6 months. And that was fine with me. But he now has a lifetime ban on owning firearms, which to me is more important.
Right. And how concerned were you or at the time that he would make good on his threat? He was basically upset about a vaccine requirement for kids and said that he would come and find you.
Yeah, it wasn't a vaccine requirement. It was actually a bill I was authoring to allow teenagers to get vaccinated on their own, not require them, but just to empower them to do that. But I was very concerned. So I get an enormous number of death threats. It's been thousands in the last few years. And there are, you know, death threats that you receive that look ridiculous, or they're from, you know, 3,000 miles away. But this one was very specific. He was from the East Bay, said he was going to come find me with a rifle. He put as his return address the Moscone Center, and of course George Moscone was the mayor of San Francisco in the 70s, who was assassinated. And then when they went to search him, they found rifles in the trunk of his car. So that was very specific and tangible. He was in the Bay Area, so that was very, very scary.
How many of these specific threats have you received?
I don't know the exact number. It's significant. It's not, you know, of the thousands we've gotten, they're not all specific. There's a subset that are, but it's quite a few. There was another one in Los Angeles where they found the guy and they prosecuted him and he ended up pleading guilty. There are others that they can never identify the person. But the bigger picture is that it really degrades democracy, because when elected officials make decisions, whether it's how to vote or whether to introduce legislation and so forth, the only things that we should have in mind is what's the best policy and what is best for my constituents? What do my constituents want? And here we have a third factor, which is someone going to kill me if I do this? And that should never be in the back of an elected official's head, because that completely undermines democracy.
Is it in the back of your mind, though, when you discuss certain bills that you might think are triggering to certain people, so to speak?
It is. It doesn't stop me from doing it. I think I have a certain kind of personality where I refuse to let that influence how I do my job. If I would do that, I wouldn't want to be in elected office anymore. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, we are contemplating whether to reintroduce the teen vaccine bill next year. It came very close to passing this year, but fell a couple of votes short on the assembly floor. And we may reintroduce it next year. We haven't decided, but I know that if I do so, there will be threats again. Anytime I author legislation for the LGBTQ community, I get threats from that. I did a bill this year to protect trans kids and their families if they're being criminalized in their home state and they want to come to California. We want to provide them refuge. I got enormous toxic stuff from that bill. So it'll never stop me, but it's unfortunate that I have to factor it in terms of, okay, if I do this, my staff and I have to be prepared for the consequences.
So what do you think is behind it? Do you think it is because of the pandemic and how people are suffering maybe mentally? Obviously, many have suffered physically, but that the pandemic has really caused a breakdown in certain people?
Well, I think over the last few years, the conspiracy theories have just exploded. We saw the explosion of QAnon. And my first avalanche of death threats was very QAnon focused because I authored a law in 2020 to provide that LGBTQ young people would be treated the same as straight young people when we decide who goes on the sex offender registry. Like when a 19-year-old has sex with a 17-year-old, which is statutory rape, the law was that a judge could keep the straight kids off the registry if there was no victimization, if it was just a partner kind of thing. But the LGBTQ kids had to go on, and the judge had no discretion. And that was a discrimination built into our sex offender statute from the 1940s. And so we wanted to equalize it to say everyone gets treated the same. Law enforcement supported it, had very broad support, but QAnon went crazy about it. You had people like Donald Trump Jr. and Rush Limbaugh and Ted Cruz basically lying and saying that we were trying to legalize pedophilia, which was absolutely false, but that caught on. And so you had these QAnon conspiracy theories that, yes, there are some deluded and mentally unstable people, but to be clear, leadership in the Republican Party were fanning the flames of QAnon, and they continue to do so today. And now there are all sorts of other conspiracy theories run amok on social media, and that leads people to make threats. Because if they believe that people like me or Hillary Clinton or whoever are somehow engaging in rings of pedophilia, I mean, it's completely made up, but if they believe that, then they'll believe that we're a threat to their children, and they may take very extreme action as a result. So these conspiracy theories have really picked up in the last few years. They've always been with us, but they've accelerated. And the Republican Party, unfortunately, has stoked the flames. Not all Republicans, but some of the real leadership have really stoked the flames.
Mm-hmm. So what does this mean for you and others on the local level trying to do your job? Do you think you need more security? And if so, how does that get paid for?
It's a huge conundrum because, yes, we do. But we know that the vast majority of members of Congress get very little, if any, security. And they get a lot of death threats. In the legislature, we have security in the Senate and California Highway Patrol, but there's no limits to what they can do. They're not with us 24/7. The ones who can have it sometimes the worst are local elected officials, city council members, school board members. We know at school boards the last few years, it's been completely toxic, and school board members get threatened all the time. They have access to no resources whatsoever. And the resources required to provide every elected official meaningful security would just be extraordinary. And I'll be honest, I don't want 24/7 security. That's not how I want to live my life.
Right. And so you are in this conundrum. You're taking a greater risk by being a public elected official these days.
I am. Absolutely. My mother texted me after the Paul Pelosi story came out demanding that I start wearing a bulletproof vest. I politely told her that I was not going to do that. But, people have a lot of concerns. And you know, there are a lot of good people who may consider running for office who would be excellent candidates and excellent elected officials who decide, you know what, it's not worth it. I don't want to put myself or my family in the middle of this toxicity. And politics can be toxic enough as it is, and then you throw on the threats and the potential violence, it's no wonder that some people decide to take a pass. And that, again, is really bad for democracy.
Well, Scott Wiener, I hope you stay safe, and thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Scott Wiener, Democratic State Senator who represents San Francisco. Coming up, roots musician Rhiannon Giddens tells us how she wrote her first opera about an enslaved man named Omar.
You sing and you tell a story through your singing and you create a character. That is a great showcase for really big emotions.
That's next on Press Play.
My daddy wore a cap like yours.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
He got down on his knees and he faced the rising sun and he did it again when the day was done.
That's musician and composer Rhiannon Giddens singing Julie's aria. It's from her new opera called Omar, which is now up at LA Opera. Omar tells the story of Omar Ibn Said. He was a real man who was taken from what's now Senegal in 1807 and enslaved in North and South Carolina. What's remarkable about Omar is he wrote an autobiography while he was enslaved in Arabic, and it's the only known account of the transatlantic slave trade written in that language. Rhiannon Giddens collaborated with composer Michael Abels to create the opera. Abels is known for scoring Jordan Peele's films, Nope, Us, and Get Out. And they both join me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. All right, so Rhiannon, let's begin with you. How did you first come across Omar's story? How did you learn about him?
Well, I mean, the kind of, I would say shocking, but it's not shocking, thing is that I had never heard of him. I mean, I'm from North Carolina, born and raised. It would be thought of as sort of a North Carolina ambassador, and I didn't know this very, very important North Carolina story. I was hip to the story by the folks who were running the Spoleto USA Festival in Charleston, Nigel Redden and Nicole Taney, and they asked me if I'd ever heard of him, and I said no, and then discussion moved to the idea of writing an opera on his life.
Yeah, well, suffice to say that he is not well known, or wasn't well known, and has such a remarkable story. So tell us a little bit more about what you found out about him, who he was, his life before he was taken to Charleston.
What we know of his life, we know through him. And then you try to supplement with historical records and books. But, you know, he was a studier of the Quran. He lived in Fototoro in Senegal, West Africa. And he was 37 when he was stolen. And we don't know a ton of facts about, you know, his daily life or you know, because the autobiography itself is slim, you know, it's not a huge document. There's not a lot of details about his daily life in Africa, but you can gather a lot of things from what we do know. And then he was stolen at 37, which is an amazing age. You're a fully formed person. He was already very deep in his studies and then has to, you know, is brought to an entirely new world where, you know, he's not hearing his language or languages or, you know, his religion. He's expected to change who he is. And how do you survive that? And what is going on inside Omar is kind of where I ended up.
Right. So I guess you took a lot of creative license and tried to imagine what it was like to be him on the ship when he arrives and then his, you know, enslavement for what? The rest of his life, I guess.
Yeah, he died enslaved, and you have to, you know, kind of accept your lens. You know, my approach is I'm a North Carolina native. I'm a Black woman. I'm not Muslim, you know, and so there was a lot of discovery for me, but I'm also very, very deeply steeped in the history of the 1800s you know, in the United States around slavery and the day-to-day life in North Carolina at that time. And so it was kind of like I was pulling on a deep well of things that I've been working on for years, you know, and then combining that with a lot of learning about Islam and about West Africa and about Islam in West Africa and like just trying to, you know, pick my way through his story. I hope that there are like 10, 15 other Omar stories, ways through his life, but I had to just sort of pick the path that seemed right to me. So that was, it was an interesting combination of discovery and sort of deeply rooted things.
And Michael, how did you get involved?
I got involved when Rhiannon asked me to collaborate. And I think I said yes before she even got the end of the sentence out, because I'm a huge fan of her work and I'm a fan of opera as well. So I thought, well, that's a yes. And what's the story about?
And had you ever written an opera before, the music for an opera?
I'd written a short opera for a school's program, but I hadn't written a full-length grand opera. So that was definitely a bucket list checkoff item for me.
Right. And Rhiannon, you hadn't either, right?
Yeah, no.
But you sang opera. We've talked about that before.
Yeah, I sang opera and I had a very keen sense, I think, of opera, because I didn't just sing it. I also lived and breathed it and ate it for many years, you know, and looked at libretti and, you know, thought about how stories were made. You know, I look back on this thinking about it now, you know, oh, of course, it actually makes a lot of sense that I would have an affinity for, you know, how an opera goes. But mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't equal writing one, you know, it was
right.
Definitely a nice tool in the tool shed though.
But I wonder why this form to tell this story, why an opera?
Well, we're getting that question a lot, and I think it just shows how opera has been put in a box and sort of, mm-hmm. you know, put on a shelf. It's a very old art form. It didn't come out of the elites. You know what I mean? It's music drama. That's what opera yeah. is. You sing and you tell a story through your singing and you create a character on stage. And so that is a great showcase for really big emotions. It's a great showcase for really big stories. And what bigger story than being torn from your homeland and having to learn, you know, how to live in a new place, how to hold your religion, how to hold your culture while you're being sort of torn down at every turn. That's very operatic.
And so musically, Michael, how do you interpret that? Because I imagine there is so much musical tradition you could draw on, not only from the southern United States, but also from Africa, from West Africa.
Yeah, it was a really fun opportunity, actually, to incorporate as many different styles of American music that have been influenced or outright invented by Black people, not only from 1800, but all the way to the present. So we had a lot of opportunity to incorporate Senegalese influence and influence of the Muslim diaspora in general, but then also ragtime and hoedown and some blues, just everything that puts the story in the location that it happened, but also in American history and our place in the culture. I thought my job was to make sure that Rhiannon could have her creative process, and then at the end, we could have an opera. And I felt that we quickly aligned on some key things. I mean, she talked about how she had been steeped in opera and knew what opera sounded and looked like. And so I could hear that, yes, you know, it was we shared that same sort of vision. So I just wanted to make sure that there was sort of a harmonic language of opera that has kind of a grand sweep to it. And sometimes it's very dark and uncomfortable in the right places. And so we were able to really contrast the beauty of some of the melodies, which are in some ways folk melodies, with some of the real dark implications where that was appropriate. And we also agreed that we didn't want to have any non-traditional orchestral instruments. I mean, surprisingly, there isn't a banjo in the score, but we chose that early on because we didn't want there to be any obstacles to have this work being performed by opera companies all over the world. So it allowed us also to use all these different musical influences and different styles of music, and yet have it all come together because it's all being told through an operatic and orchestral palette.
I think the collaboration that Michael and I have had on this has been so remarkable because it is really a combination of two compositional approaches, but are at the root, we are the same, like how we think about things and, you know, the grand scheme of how we work within genres and like in take different influences and bring them in was very similar, but just the way that I approach things, you know, is all orally, you know, and so I created things with banjo lines and vocal lines and, you know, the here's what I intend for the harmony, but I don't know enough Western harmony to write it down, but I can hear it in the voice. And then there's so much space for Michael to feel where he could actually really be creative and put in the flavors and the textures that he knows so intimately on the orchestra that I have no idea, you know? So the way he built it out was just, yeah, it's just really gorgeous.
Can you talk about visually what it looks like? Because an opera is, as you say, it's not just music. It's also a big stage production. And visually, operas can be quite arresting. And how did you want to portray Omar's enslavement and who he was on stage visually?
Oh, my gosh. So this is you say, why opera? This is another reason why opera, because opera is an intersection of so many different disciplines. So we're just one piece of it. Like obviously can't exist without the music and the words. But the way the whole thing looks is just, I couldn't have imagined it. It's just stunning. You can tell I'm super blown away by it. But that's, you know, that's their art and our art coming together. That's why opera is amazing. That's why opera, you know, because you have everything, you have the visuals, you have the drama, you've got the music, you have the lights, you have all of these different pieces coming together and everybody's an expert in their own field. And then we make this thing that's greater than the sum of its parts. Sorry, I get excited. Mm.
Yeah, no, it sounds incredibly transporting. Tell us more though about Omar, what happened to him and how was he able to write his autobiography?
The reason I sort of put things the way that I did in the libretto, because I had to create a libretto out of nothing, you know, like we had Omar's, well, it's not nothing, obviously we had Omar's autobiography, but the autobiography is very thin, you know, and there's a lot of quotes from the Quran. And then there's a sort of very, you know, kind of straightforward, basic, how he got to the States, you know, or how he got up to North Carolina. And then we have some of his other writings, but, you know, really he has this terrible master in Charleston that he runs away from, and then he gets recaptured in North Carolina and ends up spending the rest of his life, you know, with quote unquote a kind master. And, you know, it's just so hard to try to represent all of that while also saying, you know, it's still slavery, which is why the two masters are played by the same baritone. You know, it's two sides of the same coin, basically. But he was fortunate to find a man who was you know, a religious person and expected Omar to convert, but also did not work him. He was recognized for his literacy and for his intelligence by his owner in North Carolina, which was the good fortune because it meant that he could, you know, he could live in a way that was better than a lot of other options. And they encouraged him to write in Arabic. And of course they also encouraged him to convert and expected him to convert. So that's the cage, you know, mm-hmm. But it allowed him to write to, you know, to speak to us, which is really, really amazing. So, you know, that was good fortune. I feel like for us overall.
Well, it does definitely pique your curiosity into how many other Omars were there and how many more Muslims were taken. That's a side of slavery that we don't know much about. And how many other people who could have written their autobiography were literate, were able to read and write, and what they would have said.
This is the thing. I mean, I think that's the whole point of highlighting this story, is that it complicates the narrative of what is the American story. You know, nobody was a blank slate when they got here, whether they were brought here against their will or whether they came because they were being pushed out of wherever they were. That's why I never use the word slave. It's like enslaved person, because that person was a person. You know, we are able to draw strength from each other's stories, and that's how we build empathy. And the more varied and different viewpoints we put out there, the more we realize in actuality we're all going through very similar things.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today, and congratulations on your opera.
Thanks.
Yes. Thank you, Madeline.
It's very exciting. Rhiannon Giddens and Michael Abels, they wrote and composed the new opera Omar, which is on stage now at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and it'll be up until November 13th. Coming up, need some Halloween movie recommendations? We have them next on Press Play.
Happy Halloween, and welcome to Press Play on KCRW. Now with something hauntingly delightful, your host, Madeline Brand.
I've never been called hauntingly delightful before, but I will take it. Okay, well, if you're passing out candy tonight, or maybe you're just looking for a good scary movie to cuddle up to, or maybe listen to while you hide under a blanket or something, we have some horror films for you, curated by one of our regular movie critics, Jacqueline Coley, editor at Rotten Tomatoes. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Madeline. So glad to be back.
So glad to have you. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you.
Thank you. And you put together a list of the best horror films of the year, and we're going to talk about your top three. And let's begin with number three. This one's called The Innocents. It's a Norwegian film about a group of children with mysterious powers.
Ska vi visa nå?
Okay. Vem har du snakket med?
Okay, I don't know quite what they're saying there, but it sounds creepy. What's happening?
Yes, yeah, so The Innocents. This one is a film, like I said, if you would think back to the early 2000s, Let the Right One In, this is very along that. Children left to their own devices, getting into some very scary things. This takes place on essentially what's like a council flat in a Nordic village, and these young kids discover that due to where they live, they are have strange happenings that they are now responsible for. They sort of maybe get enlisted with powers. You remember Chronicle from a few years ago? Mm-hmm. If you age those kids down by like 6 years, you're right alongside with what The Innocents does. But it is even more terrifying because this is very Lord of the Flies, kids doing what they shouldn't do, but also having to fight back. Very fun adult kid watch.
And is there a kid who's possessed? Because whenever I think of scary kids, I think Damien.
I don't know if the film, if I recall correctly, I saw this one at Sundance and then I like revisited it here. I don't think it explicitly says what is causing these sort of demonic goings on, but the kids are actually in control. That is the scary part. Like, it doesn't say why these kids have these powers, but they're able to do some very sinister things.
Oh my gosh, this is a parent's worst nightmare, that the kids actually know that they're in control.
Or a kid's favorite nightmare, right?
Exactly. This is not a horror film for the kids. Okay, let's move on. That one is called The Innocents. And let's move on to your number two. This one is called Hellbender. And it follows a mother and daughter who are in a heavy metal band together.
Magic comes from the fear. Fear of death. Every living thing has it. The more fear pumping through the blood, the more power.
You've opened a door that, once it's open, it can be hard shut.
I shouldn't have kept this from you. It was a mistake.
Liar.
Ooh. Okay, this is on the streaming service Shudder, an original film released by that streaming service. And tell us what the plot is here.
This actually follows a mother-daughter duo that basically learned that they have deep roots in history with the occult and witches. And on top of the fact that it harkens back to these slasher metal worship the devil bands of like the 80s and 90s, it also really has an interesting sort of dark familial twist to it. It's got a lot of dark comedy, but at the heart of it is, you know, mother and daughter getting into the family business, as it were.
I couldn't even watch the whole trailer. It was so disturbing.
It's not an easy watch by any means, but it does like lean into a couple of the films that we have on this list, which is the macabre.
Yes.
Where it's like, this is almost entertaining with how gruesome and dark it is. But again, a metal band that's also witches, there's some comedy in there.
Yeah. And maybe some good music, or maybe not.
Yeah. I wouldn't, this is where I'm going to date myself. It's not my music. But I'm not going to pretend like they didn't put art and craft into it. How about that?
Okay. Very diplomatic of you.
Sorry. I don't want to like get the metalheads listening to KCRW coming for me in my comments.
I know. That's all our entire fan base is metalheads. Metalheads exactly. Only listen to Press Play. Okay. Hellbender on Shudder. Moving on to your favorite horror film of the year. It's called Sissy. And this is about a social media influencer who advocates for mental health online, but she has her own dark secret.
Oh my God, it's you.
How's it been? Like 12 years?
You remember me, right?
Yeah.
I just can't picture myself without her.
I was thinking about you the other day, and now here you are.
You should come to my hen's weekend.
He then died.
I am loved. I am special. I am enough.
Oh my gosh, I already have chills. What is this movie about?
Basically, the idea of it is that these two young girls are in the fight together against online bullying. And one of them basically becomes the ultimate bully Mike Myers villain in Sissy. It is the ultimate hero turned villain tale, has a really dark comedic twist. So it's the ultimate case of almost Jennifer's Body in reverse.
Oh my gosh. Well, we're going to get to Jennifer's Body next. But before we do that, why is this your number one? Why is this your favorite of the year?
The best part about Sissy, in addition to the fact that it has this jaw-dropping visual imagery of this young girl doing her best sort of zombie impersonation as she's terrorizing the town, is it's a really interesting take on the evils of modern-day teens. They're not as afraid of Freddy. They're more afraid of the girl on the other side of the keyboard. And so I think it's a great subversion of what terrifies young adults, which is the primary horror audience.
Oh, yeah. Being excommunicated on social media is the worst horror of
the worst all. Exactly. Oof.
Okay, well, let's get to Jennifer's Body now, because this is part of the Rotten Movies We Love. Okay, you've put together a list of old favorites that are really so bad they're good.
Some of them are. I mean, this whole list comes from the impetus of our book Rotten Movies We Love, and one of the sections is So Bad We're Good, but some of them are movies before their time, in the case of, I think, our one of our entries, and some of them are just movies that had a very niche but passionate audience. It really is all over, but the idea being that the audience, or maybe the estimation of the film, has shifted from what the score is.
Okay, so one of the ones you've picked for us to revisit is the 2009 film Jennifer's Body. It's a horror comedy starring Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried.
Hey, Jennifer, you look really pretty.
Why don't you just come by my place?
Well, this is random.
This isn't really your house, is it?
We can play mommy and daddy.
No way.
No, I'm killing boys.
Are you scared?
I thought you only murdered boys.
I go both ways.
Okay, it's a funny slasher movie. It stars Megan Fox at her apex. And tell us more.
I mean, this is what's so funny, is this was at the time dismissed as this just laughable teen sex horror comedy. And it has grown in the estimation of so many folks in recent years, to the point where I just saw an online fan campaign to get new posters for it. But yeah, it's Megan Fox in the ultimate height of her powers post-Transformers, plays a possessed succubus who is out to eat the boys of the neighborhood, as the quote that you pulled from the iconic trailer tells us. It's such a camp and fun thing. And what's really great is the filmmaker behind it, Kara Kusama, is absolutely the perfect person to helm this, because it subverts classic horror, which she showed she has such an aptitude for the film that most people actually remember for her later, and that's The Invitation. Like, she is such a horror head. That's why Jennifer's Body plays so well as, like, I think a heightened parody of that genre.
Hmm. So is it scary or is it funny? Or
it's a little bit scary in the sense there's definitely jump scares and thrilling and creepy moments, but it's really more of a girl power anthem. It has way more action in it. And I think especially for Megan Fox at that time in her career, what it's really subverting is the final girl trope, just this idea of what the final girl should look like, and really showing that girl turn into the monster, and the girl that probably dies in the first act of most horror films ends up being the hero. It's such a great play on both. And so, yeah, not scary, but definitely something that if you love horror, you're going to appreciate how smart it is.
All right. That's Jennifer's Body. Moving on to another bad yet good horror film is the 2008 thriller The Strangers, starring Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman. Their characters, they're a couple. They're spending time in a secluded summer house when crazy people show up at the door with masks.
What is it, like 4 a.m?
Hello?
You're gonna die.
Ah, okay. No, that's scary to me. Is this a really scary movie? It sounds like it.
Yeah, it really is. And it plays into something that a lot of people have been terrified about since the 1960s, and that is home invasions. Mm. And just this idea of something coming into your home to terrorize you has become essentially something that no one can walk away from. This one was not like a hit in theaters, but it became like a sleeper hit that folks told their friends about. It never was in like the top three in the box office after opening weekend, but it still managed to be a film that folks have like loved, particularly Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman, because they play the ultimate sort of, oh, you don't want these people to be terrorized. They're too pretty and nice. It's just like the ultimate of that. And it's gotten a couple of sequels since then.
Okay, so The Strangers, a 2008 film you can find online somewhere. Moving on to our last pick, this one is called Tales from the Hood, a 1995 cult classic. We're really reaching back. Executive produced by Spike Lee, and here's a clip.
Where the f*** did your little black ass come from? Huh? You think you and some old voodoo f*** could scare me out of my house? I don't care how many slaves died here. You get no reparations. No reparations!
Ooh, okay, so that's Corbin Burson. For you old timers, that's the blonde guy from L.A. Law. And
definitely.
He is, I guess, playing to type because he looks like some yuppie with his red suspenders. And he's being stalked by a black puppet. So tell us more.
So this is what's great. Tales from the Hood is basically, I would say, the urban take on Tales from the Crypt. It has its sort of crypt keeper showman who is playing these interstitial horror films within the narrative that are stitched together by both horrific things, but more particularly the horrific act of racism that sort of plagues the black community. And so the comedy of this rich yuppie being terrorized around his house by a little black plaything is like this ultimate bit of comedic subversion. There's also several scenes that play out the way they do in sort of action films with, you know, the racist cop or the guy in the midst of a robbery, and then they take this strange, sometimes hilarious, sometimes comedic turn. This was actually a film that was featured quite heavily in the Shudder documentary Horror Noir, because it was literally one of the first films by modern Black filmmakers to also key into horror tropes, and that goes back to some of the most iconic films within horror, like Night of the Living Dead.
Right, and so it's actually making, obviously, when he says no reparations, making a social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Along the lines of maybe like Get Out.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in the Horror Noir documentary, Jordan actually spoke very eloquently about how Tales from the Hood was an inspiration in part for Get Out. The DNA of sketch comedy and horror are very similar. This idea of setup,
subversion payoff and joke. And another one that is in our book, Rotten Movies We Love, that is also the horror entries, The Leprechaun. Just the comedy of a foreshortened person that is essentially meant to be the giver of gold and trinkets to now be the thing that is terrorizing the neighborhood is kind of comedic to especially American audiences that don't know the real stories of leprechauns, which in Ireland are way not fun.
Yeah. Yeesh. No one wants a leprechaun showing up at their house with gold
exactly.
or not.
No, with gold you. Or not, yeah. But these all play in there. And I really do love that the DNA of these Black filmmakers is part in there because there is a certain aspect of the American experience for African Americans that is horrific. And movies like Tales from the Hood and Get Out play that perfectly.
All right. You have given us a lot to watch and maybe a lot to be scared of. But anyway, thank you so much. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Madeline.
That's Jacqueline Coley, editor at Rotten Tomatoes. And all of these movies we've been talking about, you can either buy, rent, or stream on demand.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise. And suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the Monster Mash.
All right, well, if you're doing the Monster Mash, have a great time tonight or whatever you're doing for Halloween. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Monster Mash from my laboratory in the castle.